Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Trout Bomb by John Gearock. Narrated by David Colacci. Calling fishing a hobby is like calling brain surgery a job. Paul Schoellery. Foreword. No one under the age of 30 qualifies as a trout bum. The whippersnapper living along a stream or traveling from river to river isn't a bum because he isn't committed to a way of life. He's on an adventure. He hasn't actually rejected such encumbrances as a wife, children, and house payments. He just hasn't gotten around to considering them yet. But the 30 or 40-year-old man, or of course woman, who commercially ties just enough flies, guides just enough clients, or sweeps just enough floors so that he can spend the rest of his hours on the water, is a derelict in the eyes of the world who should confess his sins. Better yet, he should put that confession into writing so that the rest of us can cluck over his misspent life. Ever notice, though, that most of the books in our great angling tradition have not been written by trout bums? The men who question perceptively or reminisce lovingly on fly fishing usually work at full-time jobs. Angling for them is often an escape, an idyllic interlude, rather than an everyday fact of life. But there is a subculture in fly fishing. The trout bum, or salmon bum, bass bum, or tarpon bum. There's nothing unique about this. Skiing, surfing, and skin diving have their unemployed or barely employed contingents. These people are typically the best at their avocation. And why not? They live for little but their passions. As a group, trout bums are as intelligent, perceptive, talented, and well-educated as other fly fishermen. Maybe they make less money per year than most fly fishermen, but that has to be by choice. If bums is a negative term, it is precisely because such people are poverty-stricken not by circumstance, but by self-determination. They have decided, for reasons of their own, to pursue the American dream. Paul Schoellery, angling historian and author, has stated, "The modern trout bum is underrepresented in fishing writing." Why should that be? Is the act of fishing every day itself such a comment that there's no need to put feelings or ideas into words? Why haven't these masters of the sport, friends of mine such as Paul Brown and Wayne Huft qualify, dominated the world of angling magazines and books? They have the poetry in their souls and the strategies in their minds. Who knows the Henry's Fork better than Paul? Who understands the Missouri as fully as Wayne? Not any weekend angler like me, or most of us fly fishermen. If the great philosophical question is why, then the only answer broad enough to cover it is, why not? Trout bums avoid the societal pressures to lead normal lives by answering, why not fly fish? To them, at least, the chance of being a corporation president, a real estate magnate, or a media star pales against the chance to spend a day on the stream. Fair enough. So who's jealous of the SOBs anyway? It's obvious why trout bums are underrepresented in angling literature. Writing is so often an act of ego, and anyone who cares so little about what the world thinks of him isn't going to be the moiling mass of insecurities that drives a person after glory. When a trout bum writes, it is for money, enough at least to let him fish most of the time. When a trout bum writes well, it is because he's a craftsman, taking pride, not falsely, not inflated, in his skill as a wordsmith. Writers who are prolific without being hackneyed are all too rare. For me, at least, the first ones who come to mind are Charles Waterman, Gerald Almy, and John Gearock. My task here is to assure the listeners about John Gearock's qualifications for writing this book. No problem. He's a bum. He's the type that every father worries about his daughter bringing home. There's a magnificent streak of independence in John. That, along with an obvious love of trout fishing, lets him lead a lifestyle that makes being on the water a priority. He's a real fly fisherman, not an armchair observer who reports on other anglers' exploits or parrots other anglers' ideas. Last spring we spent a week together on the Blackfoot Reservation in northern Montana. There were no fancy accommodations or posh eateries. There wasn't even a reliable source for angling information. We bounced over dirt roads and flogged prairie potholes day after day. Each night we spread out wet equipment and clothing, hoping it would be dry by morning, and ate cold snacks before bedtime. Every frosty dawn we scrambled out again after the elusive trophy trout. The rains came and broke the spring drought. More water fell in 5 hours one afternoon than had blessed that region in 5 months, and it fell on us. It stirred up the rainbows of the rich lakes, though, so when the old Indian stopped us and said, "I'm a medicine man and it's going to rain for 5 days straight," we didn't know whether to consider it a curse or a promise. Only one other fisherman came that evening to Kipp's Lake, and he sat in his car and watched his propped-up bait rod. The rain began right away, steady enough even at first to make us hunch down in our slickers. The storm ballooned into a downpour, and the wind, a blow unimpeded by trees or hills out there, pushed the drops ahead, harder and harder, until the sheet water pounded us in 30 to 40 mile-per-hour gusts. It got so bad that the man in the car couldn't take it anymore, and he left. We stayed. We finally figured out enough about Kipp's Lake to catch some of its huge rainbows. My first trout of the following day, a 6-pound fish, impressed us. John's first trout, an 8-pound hen, so young, with a hump of fat over its back, awed us. Those hours could have been whiled away in a bar. There was one just up the road, and no one would have blamed us. But John never considered it, or at least he never mentioned it. He was there to fish. He had the will of a man who works the water every day, who takes whatever weather arises and catches trout anyway. A trout bum with a Western flavor. John is such a splendid example of a trout bum, and everything unique and free about such anglers, that it's a shame he can't stay that way forever. He's too good a writer to escape success. Worse still, he's so conscientious, turning in polished pieces on time, that magazine and book editors won't stop heaping assignments on him. By writing books, he is gaining too much status as an authority. That's what books, much more so than articles, do for an author. He started with Fly Fishing the High Country, a small but very informative volume, and has now produced Trout Bum, the kind of philosophical and humorous naturalism that could turn him into a cult figure, a Thoreau in baggy waders. My favorite pieces include both funny and thoughtful parts of the book. It's going to be hard for people not to chuckle over a chapter like Zen and the Art of Nymph Fishing, and difficult for listeners not to think long afterwards about a piece like The Fly Rod. This book is going to convert a lot more fishermen into devoted Gearock fans. It would be sad if on our next trip to the reservation John drove up in a 40-foot Winnebago, or had his film crews there for a television show, or insisted on displaying his Gearock designer waders. Somehow the thought of him chilling his wine in the muck of Kipp's Lake doesn't sound as much fun as a tepid can of beer and a Twinkie after a day of dog-crazy flogging. My bet is that his growing reputation isn't going to change John too much. He may weaken a bit under the pressure from editors and produce more articles and books, but his sense of craftsmanship will ensure the quality of his writing. And nothing is likely to lessen his intensity on the water, stemming as it does from an instinctive fascination with fish. He'll stay a trout bum as long as he appreciates the freedom he has to live his angling life on a day-to-day basis. Gary LaFontaine, 1986. Chapter 1. Trout. Let's say you're nymph fishing on Colorado's South Platte River. You've hiked up into the canyon where those deliciously deep potholes are, the big fish water, but have found that today the trout are working the shallow, fast runs. It took you 2 hours to figure that out, but it's a good sign. They're hungry, and, as your partner says, they are looking up. You're fishing a scud pattern, not the scud pattern, but one you worked out yourself. The differences are minute, but are enough to make it your fly, and you are catching fish on it, which is highly satisfactory. You're working near the edge of a fast rip about 30 yards above a strong plunge pool, flipping the weighted nymph rig upstream and following its descent with the rod tip. Your concentration is imperfect as you toy with the idea that this is okay, a fascinating and demanding way to fish, actually, but that too many days of it in a row could make you homesick for the easy grace of real fly casting. At the little jiggle in the leader that was just a hair too intelligent-looking to be nothing but current or a rock, you raise the rod to set the hook, and there's weight. And then there's movement. It's a fish. It's a big fish, not wiggling but boring, shaking its head in puzzlement and aggravation, but not in fear. It's impressive. Almost lazily, the trout rises from the bottom into the faster current near the surface, rolls into the rip, and is off downstream. What you feel is more weight than fight, and the wings of panic begin to flutter around your throat. This is the once or twice a year, oh shit, fish. You should have tried to catch a glimpse of him when he turned, the only glimpse you may get, but it all happened so fast. No, it didn't. It actually happened rather slowly, almost lazily, as you just pointed out. You are careful. Too careful? Not careful enough? The hook is a stout, heavy wire number 10, but the tippet is only a 5X, about 4-pound test. The rod is an 8.5-foot cane with plenty of backbone in the butt, but with a nicely sensitive tip. Catalog talk, but true. The drag on the reel is set light, and line is leaving it smoothly. You drop the rod to half-mast to give the fish his head, and are in fact doing everything right. It's hopeless. The trout is far downstream now, on the far side of the rip and the plunge, but the local topography makes it impossible for you to follow. The line is bellied, no longer pointing at the fish. At some point you are struck by the knowledge that the trout, that enormous trout, is no longer attached to you and all your expensive tackle, though you missed the exact moment of separation. You reel in to find that he did not throw the hook, but broke you off fairly against the weight of the river. You get a mental snapshot of your fly hanging in the hook jaw of a heavy, what, a rainbow? More likely a brown. You'll never know. Losing a fish like that is hard. Sure, you were going to release him anyway, but that's not the point. The plan was to be magnanimous in victory. You ask yourself, was it my fault? A typically analytical question. You can avoid it with poetry of the it's just nice to be out fishing variety, or you can soften it with the many levels of technical evasion, but there's finally only one answer. Of course it was your fault. Who else's fault would it be? Your partner is out of sight, and although you would have hollered and screamed for him and his camera had you landed the fish, it's not even worth going to find him now. When you finally meet in the course of leapfrogging down the canyon, you'll say that a while ago you executed an LDR, long-distance release, on a hog, which will summarize the event as well as anything else you could say. A trout, on this continent at least, is a rainbow, golden, brookie, brown, cutthroat, or some species or hybrid of the above, though every fly fisher is secretly delighted that brook trout isn't a trout at all, but rather a kind of char. Not that it matters. Much is actually known about trout, and much more is suspected. The serious fly fisherman's knowledge of these fish draws heavily on science, especially the easy-going, slightly bemused, English-style naturalism of the last century. But it periodically leaves the bare facts behind to take long voyages into anthropomorphism and sheer poetry. Trout are said to be angry, curious, shy, belligerent, or whatever. Or it's suggested that when one takes your atoms with a different rise form than he's using on the blue-winged olives, he thought it was a caddisfly. Cold science tells us that a trout's pea-sized brain is not capable of anything like reason or emotion. That's probably true enough, but in the defense of creative thinking, I have a comment and a question. Actions speak louder than words, and if they're so dumb, how come they can be so hard to catch? The myth of the smart trout was invented by fishermen as a kind of implied self-aggrandizement. To be able to hook the wise old brown trout is one thing, but to be outsmarted by some slimy, cold-blooded sub-reptilian creature with only the dullest glimmerings of awareness is, if not degrading, then at least something you don't want to spread around. Trout are smart, boy. Real smart. The way we perceive trout is probably as faulty, from a factual standpoint, as the way they see us. But our folksy ideas about them are useful, and are in that sense correct. If you tie a streamer fly and fish it in a way designed to make spawning trout mad, and in the course of events manage to hook a few fish, then those fish were, by God, mad. End of discussion. Let's say a fisheries biologist tells you that his studies and the studies of others demonstrate that brook trout are not piscivorous. That is, they don't eat other fish. To that, you counter that you have caught countless brook trout on streamers, fish imitations, that many of the now-standard American streamer patterns were developed around the wild brook trout fisheries of the East, and that further, fly fishermen have believed brook trout to be fish-eaters for nigh on these many generations. "Well," he says, "we all know brookies are stupid." Thank you, Mr. Science. Finally, the things fishermen know about trout aren't facts, but articles of faith. Brook trout may or may not eat fish, but they bite streamers. You can't even use the scientific method because the results of field testing are always suspect. There are too many variables, and the next guy to come along may well prove an opposing theory beyond the shadow of a doubt. The hatch is the blue-winged olive, so common in the West. It's a perfect emergence from the fly fisher's point of view. Heavy enough to move all but the very largest of the trout, but not so heavy that your pitiful imitation is lost in such a crowd of bugs that the surface of the stream seems fuzzy. Oh yes, hatches can be too good. When the rise began, you fished a size 18 dark nymph pattern squeezed wet so it would drift just a fraction of an inch below the surface. This copies the emerging nymph at that point where it has reached the surface but has not yet hatched into the winged fly. Early on in the hatch, these are the bugs that are the most readily available to the fish, the ones they're probably taking even though at first glance it looks like they're rising to dry flies. The difference in position between an emerging nymph and a floating fly is the almost non-existent thickness of the surface film of the water, and there is often zero difference between the trout's rise forms. When the hatch progresses to the point where there are more winged flies on the water than emerging nymphs, you switch to the dry fly, only a few minutes after most of the trout have. There are two mayflies on the water now, identical except that one is a size 18, and the other, the more numerous, is more like a size 22. The largest is the Betis, and the smaller is the Pseudocleon. You heard that from the local expert, and looked up the spellings in Hatches, by Cauchy and Nastasi. It sounds good, but what it means is that you fish either the blue-winged olive or the atoms in a size 20 to split the difference. The fish are an almost uniform 14 to 16 inches, rainbows with a long, silvery cast to them, bodies fatter than most stream fish, with tiny little heads. They are wild and healthy, and you would drive five times farther than you did to fish here. They're rising everywhere now. In the slower water, they're dancing and darting, suspending for a few seconds now and then as if to catch their breath. They will move several inches for your fly, taking it matter-of-factly, completely fooled, but leaving you only a single precise instant that won't be too early or too late to strike. This has you wound up like the E string on a pawn shop guitar. In the faster water, they are all but invisible, but they're out there because there are enough bugs to make them buck the current. They come up from the bottom through 2 feet of water, taking the fly with such grace and lack of hesitation that the little blip on the surface seems unconnected with that fluid arc of greenish, pinkish, silvery light in the riffle. You are on, hot, wired. You've caught so many trout that the occasional missed strike is a little joke between you and the fish. This is the exception rather than the rule, the time when everything comes together. But it feels comfortable, like it happens all the time. A hint of greed creeps in. You would like maybe a little bigger trout, and to that end you work the far bank. Still, though the trout are now almost part of a process rather than individual victories, you admire each one momentarily before releasing it and going confidently for another. It's late in the hatch now. Most of the river is in shadow, and the remaining light has a golden autumnal cast to it. The little rusty brownish spinners could come on now. This could last. But it's too perfect. It can't last. Trout are wonderfully hydrodynamic creatures who can dart and hover in currents in which we humans have trouble just keeping our footing. They are torpedo-shaped, designed for moving water, and behave like eyewitnesses say UFOs do, with sudden stops from high speeds, 90-degree turns, such sudden accelerations that they seem to just vanish. They seem delicate at times, but will turn around and flourish in conditions that look impossibly harsh. They like things clean and cold. They are brilliantly, often outrageously, colored, the wild ones anyway, and are a pure and simple joy to behold, though they can be damned hard to see in the water. Even the most gorgeously colored fish are as dark and mottled on the back as the finest U.S. Army-issued jungle camouflage to hide them from predators from above, herons, kingfishers, ospreys, and, only recently in evolutionary terms, you and me. Then there are those rare times when the light and everything else is just right, when they're as exposed as birds in the sky, in open water under bright sun as if they were in paradise. At such times they can look black. You feel like a voyeur, delighted with a view of something you have no right to see. But don't feel too guilty. They'll spook at your first cast. In one sense, trout are perfectly adapted working parts of a stream, a way of turning water, sunlight, oxygen, and protein into consciousness. They feed on the aquatic insects when those bugs are active, and they all but shut down metabolically when they're not. They find glitches in the current, where even in the wildest water they can lounge indefinitely by now and then lazily paddling a pectoral fin. They have the flawless competence that even the lower mammals have lost by getting to be too smart. They operate at the edges of things, fast and slow currents, deep and shallow water, air and stream, light and darkness, and the angler who understands that is well on his way to knowing what he's doing. In another sense, trout are so incongruously pretty as to seem otherworldly. That metallic brightness, the pinks and oranges and yellows, and the spots. One of the finest things about catching a trout is being able to turn it sideways and just look at it. How can so much color and vibrancy be generated by clear water, gray rocks, and brown bugs? Trout are among those creatures who are one hell of a lot prettier than they need to be. They can get you to wondering about the hidden workings of reality. Releasing trout is a difficult idea to get hold of at first. It doesn't seem to make sense. You want the meat. You want the proof. In the beginning, catching a trout on a fly is one of those things you have to do before you actually come to believe it's possible. Those first maddening weeks or months with a fly rod make other fly casters seem like the guy in the circus who can put the soles of his feet flat on the top of his head. Sure, he can do it. If you don't flip out and go back to the spinning rod, you eventually find that it can be done, though the gap between the first time you take trout on a fly rod and the second time can be so wide you come to wonder if it ever really happened. It's easy to lose the clarity of that initial vision. You hear it all the time. I tried fly fishing, couldn't get the hang of it. You keep the early trout. Anyone who doesn't is too saintly to be normal. But in time you begin to see the virtue of releasing the wild fish. The logic is infallible. If you kill him, he's gone. If you release him, he's still there. You can think of it in terms of recycling, low impact, all the properly futuristic phrases. With some practice, it's easy to do correctly. Smaller trout can be landed quickly. The barbless hook is turned out with a practiced motion of the wrist, and it darts away, baffled but unharmed. You haven't lifted him from the water or even touched him. Larger fish require more handling. You're careful not to lift them by the gill covers or squeeze them too much, causing internal damage. A landing net with a soft cotton mesh bag helps. Big fish, played to exhaustion on tackle that's unavoidably too light, are carefully resuscitated, held gently in the current and pumped until they get their wind back and can swim off under their own steam. They seem dazed, and you know that if they were stressed too much, with too much lactic acid built up in their systems, they'll eventually die. It's something to wonder about. Some of your released fish have probably expired later, but you don't know enough about it to determine the actual medical condition of any particular one. It begins to feel good. The heft and muscle tension of a bright, pretty, live trout held lightly in the cold water. It's like a mild electric shock without the pain. Finally, there's not even an instant of remorse when they dart away. At some point, your former values change ends. The bigger the trout, the more satisfying the release. Having all but lost your taste for fish, you begin to release everything. Wild fish, stockers, stunted brook trout, whitefish, bluegills, with an air of righteousness that pains many of those around you. At some point, you become an absolute snot about it. You're incensed that even staunch anti-hunters aren't bothered by the killing of fish, that vegetarians will bend the rules for seafood. This, you come to realize, is because trout are not seen as cute by the general population, though, of course, they are wrong. You begin to feel misunderstood. That feeling can go on for years, and in some anglers it calcifies into the belief that killing a trout is murder. But maybe one day, without giving it much thought, you go down to the reservoir, after having spotted the hatchery truck there in the morning, and bag a limit of stockers, pale, sickly-looking things with faint purplish stripes where the pink stripe would be on a wild rainbow. It doesn't feel half bad. Breaded with yellow cornmeal and flour and fried in butter, they're okay, not unlike fish sticks, but with a livery undertaste. That same season, or perhaps the next, you take a brace of wild fish for what you refer to as a ceremonial camp dinner, carefully pointing out that they are small brook trout from overpopulated water. They taste good. They taste wonderful. You come to realize that you have to kill some now.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?